So I've had some conversations with people recently where they're wondering what they're doing, especially what they're doing in their practice life, their meditation life, their Buddhist practice life, and where they're going or what they should be working on. And the question, when someone questions me, you know, what should I be doing, or am I on the right track, or should I be doing some other things, or where am I going with all this? It actually puts me in a little bit difficult position, because there are so many different tracks a person can be on, that you know, who am I to say which track they should be on? I mean, I could just decide there's one track, and you know, the track I want people to be on, and then just direct them on my track. But I find that hard to do. Yeah.
Can you turn it off, please? I mean, oh no, it's not.
Yeah, when the hearing assistance devices are not in the ear, but they're plugged on, then we get this feedback. So if someone doesn't have it plugged in their ear, so what I'd like to do this morning is to talk a little bit about the notion of a path. In Pali, the word is magga. In Sanskrit, it's marga. Some of you might remember it from, they're still around in Los Altos, but they were much more known in the 70s, the Ananda Marga group. And the marga means path, Ananda means joy. And it's a very common Indian word. In fact, the word religion is a peculiar Western word which has no easy equivalent in most non-Western languages. And non-Western people have struggled a little bit with how to translate the word religion because it's so peculiar. And but the one of the ones that comes close to in Indian languages is the notion of marga or path. And Buddhism isn't, in India, classically it wasn't recognized as a religion. They couldn't because they didn't have the word. And but rather it was recognized as a path. And there were many different traditions that offered different paths that you could follow. An idea of a path also is found in China and Japan, places where they had the idea of the Tao, that you would enter a way of life, a way. And Buddhism offers a path, and sometimes that path is understood to be a path, you know, like you walk on, engage in, or sometimes it's even the idea you have to go up the mountain, it's a tough path to follow. And sometimes the so-called path is likened more to a stream, and a stream is something you enter into and it carries you someplace, and it's actually, rather than being a difficult uphill challenge, it's actually quite a natural flow. You kind of get into the flow of the stream and it naturally carries you down. And you have to harmonize with the stream, but the stream will take you where it goes. So it's not so much your effort anymore. So those are two different views that are sometimes held. And what I'd like to say today is that, offer today is a variety of views in Buddhism about the path. And my hope is that I don't thoroughly confuse you. I don't want to confuse you by offering you a lot of options. Sometimes it's easier, you come to some place and they tell you this is the right way, this is the true way, the one way, and there's a lot of clarity. And that's part of the strength of it. So so I'd like to basically kind of offer my idea, no one else's idea, but there are three different kinds of paths offered in Buddhism. One is what is the idea of a developmental path. The second is the idea of what I call the path of letting go. And the third is the path of no path. So, three ideas of a path. And the path of no path is very interesting. And it kind of exists in the context of the path, other paths. Otherwise it has no meaning. So, because if you take, you know, if you go down to El Camino here and pick up some average American guy who's buying beer for the Super Bowl, and tell him there's no path. Great, you know. You know, I never thought, you know, it never crossed my mind. I'm glad that it's considered such a high attainment. So generally the idea of a no path kind of exists in the context of the first two, somehow or other. So the first one, developmental path. And this is the one I think that has the most orthodoxy in Buddhism, the most central. The Buddha himself very clearly laid out what he called a gradual path, gradual teaching, a gradual path. And it basically follows a developmental model of a human being. Some people in a kind of modern kind of language, some people might want to say evolutionary model, that people evolve, they develop over time. And I'm very, much impressed by how human beings do develop developmentally, and especially if you see it with children. And my son goes to a school where they believe that each kid will more or less naturally learn to read when they're ready. And the different kids, different ages will learn how to read. And if you try to force them to read at first grade or in kindergarten, some kids it works. They're ready to learn at that age. And some kids are not ready. And so you actually do them a disservice. You actually cause harm by trying to force them to learn to read when their minds are not ready for that. But rather, the school then, what it's into is laying the conditions, rich conditions, environment, rich conditions, so that for each kid, when they're ready to start reading, the conditions are there that it's possible for them to learn. And so you see in my son's class, some kids are really fluent readers, second grade, are really fluent readers, and some can't read yet. Some kids, you know, it's kind of like magic when it kind of turns on. And, look, there they are. And so some parents report, you know, in the school that, you know, they get kind of worried by the end of second grade or third grade, a little bit worried, because here in a lot of places you're supposed to start learning to read in kindergarten. You know, it's kind of forced on you. And, but then it's kind of like magic. Something switches on someday, one day or something. It's just like magic. It takes over. So there are no, you know, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth graders in my son's school who do not know how to read. And it's like, you know, we were kind of slow in toilet training our kids. But it was kind of reassuring to know that by the time kids are 13, they're toilet trained. So I knew it was going to happen. You know, it's just a developmental thing. It kind of happens, you know. I didn't have to be too worried about it. So this thing about learning to read, you know, it's a developmental thing. Somehow it happens. If the conditions are rich enough for that to happen, the conditions are laid, something will happen. You don't have to force it. And then a whole bunch of things, you know, in life are like that as children grow up, that there's a whole bunch of stages of development and growth that kids go through that you could try to rush, or you could just allow it to happen its own time and its own way. And it's much more, I think, healthy for the children to let their own evolution, development happen on its own. I was trying to teach my son how to catch a baseball with a glove, I tried to give him simple ideas, like idea how you do it, how you hold. The first Darwin is like 4 or 5, like how you hold the glove. And he got really upset with me or with himself. And anytime I tried, I was very gentle and soft, you know. But you hold the glove like this, rather than always like this. Turn it over. And he would, you know, be kind of teary-eyed. And I realized, no, it doesn't work to try to tell him what to do. Let's just throw the ball back and forth. And he can catch it like this if he wants to. Let him catch the way he wants. And we threw a lot of balls. And he is a really good baseball player now. I mean, he's like, you know, people in front, wow, look at that. He can throw really hard. I mean, just yesterday, my wife said, wow. You can hear the bang, you know. Goes into my glove and it hurts. And so, you know, he can catch really well. He knows all the techniques now, but it came from repetition and practicing. In his own way, he was ready to learn how to do it. So children, as they grow up, grow developmentally. And I think there's something very profound about trusting that developmental growth and not forcing it and not fitting it into your agenda, our agenda, but creating certainly the rich conditions that allow it, that to happen. I mean, if there are no books at all in the environment, maybe the kids maybe never learn to read, right? You have to have some conditions in place. So I think the developmental model is well recognized in children as they develop. And then the question is, when we turn 18 or 21, the magic age, whatever that is, we become an adult, does the developmental development of stop? That's it. You're not allowed to develop anymore? Or is there continued development into adulthood, through adulthood, into old age? You know, are there developmental stages? Are there developmental developments, for that happen kind of naturally on its own if the conditions are there for it to happen? And I think the answer is yes. I think probably all of you who are adults have recognized yourself in various ways have grown in the time that you have been an adult. Some of the concerns, fears you might have had when you were younger, you know, are gone. I know one person who, when she was in graduate school, if you're about 20, late 20s, she was petrified to talk in front of a graduate seminar class of 8 people. I mean, it would take days of preparations and, you know, she'd be kind of frozen. She'd get up there in front of the class and be frozen. I mean, the idea of public talking in front of her other fellow students was just so petrifying. And now, 15, 20 years later, that's not an issue anymore. She can talk in front of people, and she doesn't like it exactly, but she's not petrified. So here she's learned to deal with that fear and kind of learn to evolve and grow. Just as there are developmental stages for children in their growth, it's my impression that there is developmental stages, natural ones, in the development of the parents. That just as we're parenting the children, they are childrening us. Is that the right term? The equivalent term, they're childrening us. And there's a growth and development in all kinds of situations. So it's not strange then that this would be applied also to a spiritual life. And so the Buddha had its developmental model of how you follow the path and develop the path. And what I like to argue is that if you don't take some responsibility for the development of your heart and your mind, it will develop anyway. And if you don't take responsibility for it, then it's going to be influenced by the other forces that maybe you'd rather not influence you. There are a lot of people in our society who are paid top money. Those of you who are going to watch the Super Bowl today know very much. Some of you know it's the most exciting part of the Super Bowl is the advertisements. And I've been noticing in the paper a little bit all these articles about the commercials at the Super Bowl. I think they're maybe the highest costing advertisements in television. Is that true? They're really expensive, right? So people don't pay all that money unless they think they're going to influence you or the people who watch, not you. But the people, you know, the forces in our society that want to influence our mind and our growth and who we are. And they're quite insidious, quite powerful. Politicians do it. And, you know, the politics of hate, the politics of fear go really deep into the psyche. The news of fear, the way in which fear is used on television to draw people in to watch local news, you know. And it's been reports about how the reporting of terrible tragedies, local tragedies, has gone up while the number of tragedies have gone down. And so the impression you get from television that things are really bad. And so it inculcates fear in people who are not careful. So there's these forces in our society that are going to affect our own hearts and minds, going to shape it. And if we're passive recipients to that, passive participants in that, we're going to be shaped in a certain way. No way around it. What Buddhism says, in a sense, is you should take responsibility for the shaping of your own mind and heart. You shouldn't just leave it to chance, leave it to other people to shape it, but you should take responsibility for that shaping. And the human heart, the human mind, is not a static thing. You don't get to be 21 or something, whatever age, and that's it, you know. But rather it's something that's actually always fluid. And Buddhism teaches that the mind, the heart, is a process, and a process is always changing and fluid. Now, I keep reading in the paper that they keep discovering more and more how plastic the brain is. It used to be they thought the brain was fixed, but now they realize how plastic it is. So the Buddha offered a developmental model of the path. And but there are many models of a path in Buddhism. There's one that's the one that Buddha offered, but in a sense the Buddha offered different models or different ways of holding it. He offered the Eightfold Path. He offered the 16 stages of, or the 12 stages of purification. He offered three trainings. He offered the seven factors of awakening. You know, there's various things that can understood it kind of as a path of development and growth. There's a gradual path that he described that begins with generosity and goes to ethics and goes to concentration and goes to mindfulness and other things in between. He offered a variety of paths. So which one is the right one? How should you kind of, where should you engage? Where's your starting point? And then outside of what the Buddha had to teach in Buddhism itself, there's so many different ideas of a path and directions. Now some of this idea of a path has to do where the path ends. Where's the path taking you? And there are different ideas of where the path can take you, where the end might be. And in Orthodox Buddhism, standard traditional Buddhism, as it evolved in India, there are three different goals. So, you know, there's not a unitary thing, this is the one and true goal, but there are three ultimate goals a person can pursue. There is the pursuit of your own liberation. There's the pursuit of your own liberation so that you could help and liberate a lot of other people. And then there's a third one, which is kind of like a strange category, which is you can get liberated all on your own without any help. And that very few people do that. So we usually don't talk about that one. And we don't have to talk about that because, you know, you wouldn't be here. And so the first one is usually associated with Theravadan Buddhism, that of pursuing liberation for yourself. And the second is usually associated with Mahayana Buddhism, where you pursue liberation, but it's really so that you can help liberate a lot of other people as well. It's kind of like reading enough or studying enough or whatever, doing enough work so that you can cure yourself of some illness versus curing yourself of an illness so you can, you know, and going to medical school. So if you go to medical school, then you can, you know, cure your illness and go to medical school, then you can help a lot of people who have that illness. So the second route is that of becoming a Buddha. And it's like graduate school, you know, it's like medical school. It's like, to become a Buddha, it's a lot more work. Takes a lot longer, because you have to really go to, you know, Buddhist graduate school for a long time in order to, have the kind of development, inner development and understanding and insight that allows someone to be a Buddha. Another way of talking about these two paths is that tends to be a choice that people make at some point between a path, a spiritual path, that is mostly for benefiting oneself, or a spiritual path that somehow is integrated with being of service to others. And there are people who will tell you which is the right one. And they'll put, you know, there's people who will criticize the other. But I think that it's really something that arises in each person's heart. That for whatever reason, if you allow the natural evolution of people's own hearts, own particular dispositions, some people are more oriented towards being of service and to the others, and some people, it's not their disposition. One's not better than the other, but it's just different way of dispositions that unfold. And that's the classic way in India, in Buddhism, is that there's understanding that different people have different dispositions, different character types. And there's a deep respect for that, And there isn't some idea that, you know, that if you have, you know, an X disposition, that you should do the Y path. If you have the X disposition, then do the X path. If you have the Y disposition, do the Y path. They're both valid and wonderful in their own right. But you have to be respectful of your own dispositions. You have to. How I like to see this is that just as children develop with the right conditions naturally, I like to see the path as something that evolves and develops inside of us when we create the conditions for it. I think it's almost like there's an inner teacher or inner guidance or inner kind of flow that happens if the right conditions are there. But it requires a deep sensitivity to ourselves. We have to be able to listen deeply. We have to be able to stop and get out of our own way. If we're always preoccupied and concerned about everything and always afraid, we can't listen that deeply to what wants to evolve or blossom inside of us. So we have to let create the conditions so that something really maybe shy can bubble up and show us where we want to go. What's our disposition? What's our direction? So as a teacher, I have kind of that view. I prefer not to tell people where they should go in their practice. Like, this is the path for you. I'm much more like trying to listen very carefully or trust very carefully that each person kind of has their own sense. I'd like to, or help a person find their own sense. You know, help a person say, if you really listen deeply in your own heart, if you have developed that, use the mindfulness to really check in with yourself deeply, what is it that wants to come forth out of you? What's next for you? What is it that you want to do? That's kind of my bias in all this, is to kind of trust the natural unfolding of where it wants to go. And I believe that with enough sensitivity, with enough care, with enough careful attention to the heart, that it's the desire for all hearts to evolve to their full capacity, or to, not to full capacity, that's the wrong thing, but to evolve to liberation, to be liberated. I think liberation is something which the movement of freedom is innate in every heart and mind. It's because, and I have an almost mechanical view of it. So it's not like some metaphysics. It's almost as mechanical as if you place a ball on a hill, it'll roll downhill. Liberation in Buddhism is freedom from clinging. And clinging takes effort. If you're going to hold and cling, you have to put effort into it. And inherent in every moment of clinging is a counterforce of release, relax. If you wind up a spring, there's a powerful force in that spring to unwind if you just let go of the plug. Or if you fill a bathtub, there's a tendency in that bathtub to drain out if you pull the cork. So, the plug. So when we cling, when the heart is contracted or tight or afraid or filled with hate or desire or whatever, that in that clinging, there's a tendency to want to have release, to let go. And that because of that tendency, I believe that it's the desire of each heart, in a sense, to want to be liberated, because to be liberated in Buddhism is to release all clinging. So it's a little bit mechanical view. So in the developmental model of the Buddha, the idea is you have to develop your character. You have to develop inner strengths, and so there's a variety of inner strengths that a person needs to work on. One of the ones that's most classically given first is generosity. And it isn't so much you should be generous for generosity's own sake, it's valuable, but you want to develop generosity because you want to develop a capacity of generosity, a character of generosity in your own psyche, in your own mind and heart. And generosity is a movement of letting go, it's a movement of openness, it's a movement of connectedness to other people, all of which are very helpful to develop. The other thing it's often emphasized is you need to develop your ethics, your integrity. And so without a developed sense of integrity, commitment to truth, non-harming, it's really hard to engage deeply in this path. So there are people who spend a lot of time developing their ethical life. I've known some people who develop their ethical life before they meditate. I was very, very touched by this when some years ago I met a woman who was a devout Buddhist, grew up Buddhist, and had a Buddhist teacher, was engaged in Buddhist Buddhist studies at graduate school, had made Buddhism her whole life. And I asked her, "Do you meditate?" And she said, "Oh no, not yet. I'm preparing myself for that. I'm not worthy of it yet. I'm not worthy to meditate." I think that was quite something. I felt, you know, you don't have to wait, but still, I was very moved that she took it so seriously that she felt she should prepare herself, make herself worthy ethically, in order to be able to be ready to meditate. So ethical development, to develop that capacity, and then to develop qualities like concentration, strengthen the mind's capacity to get concentrated, strengthen the mind's capacity to be equanimous in challenging situations, strengthen the mind's capacity to be have faith or have inspiration or have confidence. Confidence is very important. Strengthen our capacity to make effort, to have perseverance, to be patient. Strengthen our ability to be resolved and follow through in a resolve. Strengthen our loving kindness. And the list goes on and on, and after a while you get a headache. Because, you know, so many things you could do and develop. And, you know, where do you start? You could just ask me and I'll tell you where to start, if you twist my arm. Or you can kind of listen to yourself and see what is it that needs to be developed inside of you. What is it that maybe is a limiting factor for you in order to continue developing on the path? It might be that if anger is a limiting factor, maybe you need to somehow address the anger through loving kindness and develop that. Or maybe greed or fear is a limiting factor. And so maybe what you need to develop then is maybe develop generosity as a path or as a practice. Or if you're impatient, you need to develop patience. Different people have different limiting factors. So recognize what your limiting factor is and then try to work on that. And that maybe shows you what you need to work on. Part of the reason for developing these strengths, developing these inner capacities, is that the ultimate goal of liberation is not generally an easy thing to attain. It would be nice if you could just kind of sit down for 5 minutes one day and meditate and get it over with. You can get over with your life. There are important things to do, right? And so this liberation thing, you want to get it done quickly. And there are people who have that attitude, you know. Let me get it over with so I can move on with my life. But for most people, it's not an easy endeavor. The mind has to be developed to a strong degree. And it has to be a strong mind. It has to be not only a strong mind, but it has to be a very soft mind. And to develop that together, softness and strength at the same time, for many people, it takes sometimes years and years of good practice in order to develop that quality. And that both having a strength and softness in the mind sets the conditions in the mind where the mind can finally let go in a deep way, finally relax in a deep way. And the deep letting go, the deepest letting go, is synonymous with liberation in Buddhism. Some people would like to just let go, you know, as they are, but sometimes you can't really let go very well if the mind is kind of weak. The mind has to be strong and well developed. I've read that second-hand or third-hand literature that they did studies of musicians, great musicians, and they figured out, or they calculated, how many hours the musicians practiced before they were 20. Because some musicians start when they're 5, right? And they're early on. And what this study found is that the musicians who were the top rated, by the time that they were 20, had done something like 20,000 hours of practice. That's phenomenal. Those who were kind of like second rated had done, by the time they were 20, had done 10,000 hours. And those who were kind of third rated had done 5,000 hours by the time they were 20. So somehow that practice before, you know, you're young is really important. But it's the repetition that was important, doing it over and over and over again. And we'd like to believe that, you know, it's just a matter of having some innate talent and we just sit down and, you know, it's easy, right? But there's something very important that happens with repetition, doing it over and over and over again. My 8-year-old, I think he hates this idea of repetition. He wants to be perfect just, you know, first time. But he's slowly getting a sense of it. If you practice and practice, then you can learn something. And so repetition is really important for many human endeavors, just doing it over and over again. When I was in graduate school, I had this professor who I admired her scholarship greatly. And she wrote these brilliant papers. And they were so fluid, and they read almost like academic articles, they read almost like mystery novels. They were so fluid and so well written and so brilliant. And you know, I'd go home to write my papers, and it was like pulling teeth, you know, it was so hard and so slow. And then one day, she showed me an early draft of one of her papers. And to my amazement, there were all sections crossed out and corrections in the margins and arrows this way and that way. And I realized that it didn't come off her pen or computer, you know, just ready-made in this, you know, in this perfected form. It took a lot of practice and doing it over and over and over again to craft these articles for her. So this idea of repetition then is also very important in a spiritual life. Many people would like spiritual life to be easy. They feel it's somehow, if it's a really important, valid spiritual path, it should be quick and easy. Just wake me up immediately. And I think that at least classically in Buddhism and teachings of the Buddha, repetition is really important. You do it over and over and over again. You have to put in your hours. And some of this development is really slow. Some of it you don't see the results, you know, in 1 week or 1 month or even 1 year. Some areas you find receive results right away, and some results take a long time to develop. There's a story of the Dalai Lama being asked at a big teaching he was giving. Someone stood up and said, can you tell me the quick way to enlightenment? And as the story was told to me, the Dalai Lama was silent for a long time, and then apparently he started crying. And or tears went down, you know. I remember exactly what he said, but it was basically how sad he felt that people kind of were approaching Buddhist practice trying to find the quickest way. That really wasn't the point, exactly. So, I think it does take time, and it takes sometimes a long time in order to develop oneself. So what do we do? What kind of practices do we do? I think we listen to our own hearts, learning to listen. So we have to give ourselves enough time in meditation, enough time in a contemplative atmosphere to be able to listen to see what's really important. What are our important values and how we want to develop ourselves and where we want to go. And then we'll find out. When I used to do a lot of retreats, meditation retreats, at the end of the retreat, in my early years, I didn't want to do one again forever. And then 5-6 months would go by and I'd practice every day. And then it kind of this intuitive kind of sense was that I'm ready, I'd like to do that again. And then I'll go sit another retreat. And then, okay, not anymore after that for a little while. And there was kind of intuitive sense. I kind of just went along with the intuition. It was time to sit retreat. It was time to do that, to the next. But I had to listen to what was going on inside. So then there's the second path, which is the path of letting go. And that's not as much championed in Buddhism as the first one. But you do find some teachers who emphasize this almost exclusively. It's all about letting go. Let go, let go, let go. Just let go, just let go, let go, let go. Sometimes when teachers emphasize the rhetoric is all about letting go, sometimes it's in the context of like being in a monastery, being a monk, following a discipline. You know, it's a really strict environment, you know, and like you have to kind of, a lot's required of you, a lot of inner development and strength building is happening because you're in this really strict disciplined environment. And because the environment is so strict, the teacher doesn't have to say, oh, you know, develop your, you know, patience, develop your equanimity, develop your concentration. The teacher just says, you know, just let go. It's fine, it's easy, let go. Mm-hmm. Let go. And so the content, sometimes it's very interesting in Buddhism. It's very important, I think, to understand that sometimes the rhetoric, the teachings that have been given, are sometimes not, are given in a context. And sometimes if you just read the books, you miss the context. You understand that? So I saw that in the Zen monasteries in Japan, where sometimes there was a tremendous emphasis on concentration. Concentrate, concentrate, concentrate. But the whole environment was set up to support mindfulness. So the teachers didn't have to teach about mindfulness because the whole environment was about helping you be mindful. And the teacher just said, be concentrated. And if you took the instructions outside of its context, you'd think that those Zen teachers were only teaching concentration practice. So you have to understand a little bit the context. But letting go is sometimes seen as taught almost exclusively. It's very powerful to let go. And a little bit the power of it is that if you let go of clinging, then it allows the natural unfolding to happen on its own. Basically, you're getting out of your own way. Letting go simplifies all the obstructions, all the confusions, all the attachments to self that exist in the mind. And it doesn't take very long if you let go on a regular basis to begin experiencing the wonderful benefits of that. It is really wonderful to let go. The problem of letting go is sometimes if you haven't developed a lot of strength, you'll only let go, you know, how to say it, if you only let go like weakling, you'll do weak letting go. You know, and it's nice to let go, but you know, you can't really, it's not a direct parallel analogy, but it's like, you know, it's nice to lift up weights, right? You lift a 1 pound weight, it's nice a little bit. Nice to get some exercise. But you're not going to be able to lift up a 10 pound weight. So if you want to let go of, you know, 1 pound weights, you know, you have to be only be kind of a, you know, you don't have to be very strong. But if you want to let go of a 10 pound weight in the brain, in the mind, you have to be stronger, you have to develop some strength in order to do that letting go. So letting go is sometimes taught. Sometimes letting go is taught in conjunction with a path of development. The two go together very nicely. They're not to be considered separate paths. Sometimes they're considered separate, but I think best to see them as being together on the same path. That one of the strengths we need to develop is a strength to let go. That letting go is sometimes one of the things that helps us develop in other kinds of ways. And the third path is the path that is not a path, path or no path. And this has a tremendous charisma or power, authority in Buddhism, partly because the path of no path is often how reality is seen from the perspective of someone who is liberated. So someone who's done the whole path, done all the development, that's how you see it. There's no more path, right? You know where to go. You've done the work. And so when someone has done all the work, there's a way in which there's a sense of completion, sense of fullness, of just things are what they are. Also, the path of no path has a certain very powerful, it's very powerful because it's pointing to the capacity, a certain capacity of the mind, certain capacity of awareness, not to be caught in the concepts of the mind. Sometimes people talk about duality, dualities of self and other, dualities of good and bad, all kinds of dualities. Or you can talk about just concepts and comparative concepts. And most of the ways in which people suffer in their lives has its genesis in comparative thinking, in conceptual thinking. And so if you point to a certain kind of way of being alive, being present, that it's beyond the conceptual realm, beyond those kinds of dualities. It can be, but sometimes it can be satisfying very quickly. Feel very free, you can feel very open, very spacious, and all that. And so some people like to point in that direction. And some teachers are quite good at pointing to a non-dual realm or a non-conceptual realm or a kind of a place where they sometimes identify it with awakening. And one of the questions, one of the weaknesses of that approach is that sometimes people will think that there's some kind of a deep letting go when they kind of get intuitive sense or a sense of this non-conceptual realm. But they're not really free, because they're only free when they're not thinking. And there's all these latent tendencies, all these tendencies deep inside of us to cling, to hold on, to engage, to be afraid, to hate. They're still there, deep inside. But as long as they kind of space out or stay in this non-conceptual place, then it's not triggered. But bring back in the concepts, the latent tendencies are triggered, they'll come back. In order to be free, from a Buddhist point of view, like, you want to be free in all states of mind, not only in non-conceptual, non-dualistic states of mind. You should also be free when there's concepts. You should be able to engage in the world of concepts and thoughts and ideas with total freedom. And so you don't want to kind of just protect yourself from that realm, kind of come back to some place of non-conceptual. You want to, that's an important place in Buddhism, but you don't want to only stay there. You want to be able to do the inner work that allows you to let go of the deep attachments we have. Now the path of no path also has a kind of different kind of flavor, a different way of talking about it, which for me is personally is very important. And that is that one of the weaknesses of the developmental path is that the ultimate fruit of the path is only arrived at after a long period of practice. You know, it might take, you know, a long time. So say that it's gonna, you know, to really become a, you know, fully liberated for maybe say any of you, if you really want to gain follow the path all the way, maybe it's going to take you 10 years of really deep practice. Some of you might not have 10 more years to live. So what does that mean? You're left out? It's not going to happen to you? You know, I'm not going to come to IMC anymore. I'm better off playing pool or something. You know, something more fun. You know, if that, you know, it makes some sense, right? And also, for whatever reasons that are maybe quite personal, very deep, maybe, some people are not going to take the path that far. Maybe they have certain inner complexes, inner issues or inner something, who knows? They're not going to have the capacity to take it all the way. Who knows how far they can go with it? And I think it's very sad to set up, in some way or other, to set up the idea that in order to be a successful human being, a worthwhile human being, authentic human being or something, that you have to kind of reach the end of a path. I think it's really sad. I would hope that our sense of intrinsic worth of who we are as a human being is seen as just being intrinsic, who we are. We have enough sense of self-confidence and self-worth, sense of self-completion, that we don't have to get anywhere in order to feel complete. Now, if that's not true for you, then maybe you need to do the developmental path. But if it's, you know, but my hope is that people have enough sense of, you know. And the path of no path, some of the versions of it, are pointing back to the idea that right here and now, at this moment, there's a place of completion, or a place of perfection, or a place of finding a certain kind of liberation. It's not the ultimate liberation, But there's a way of being liberated in this moment right here, even though there might be buried in your psyche places still of holding, of attachment and all that. But right here, there's something very powerful. And the non-path sometimes is pointing to this right here. What's right here right now? That is luminous, that is spacious, that has a feeling of freedom, of peacefulness, of ease. And I think it's possible to taste that short of following a long developmental path. And it's said that mindfulness is one of the things that can give birth to that. That a moment of pure mindfulness, a moment of mindfulness, is, in a sense, a moment of liberation. Though it's not always so easy to see that or understand how that happens. But something about one moment of mindfulness is not for or against our experience. One moment of mindfulness is not measuring our experience. One moment of mindfulness is not clinging to experience. A moment of mindfulness, just right here and now, is complete in and of itself. And so there's a sense that you can engage in a spiritual practice like mindfulness. And even though you don't get very far according to some developmental model, it's deeply satisfying, this moment of doing the practice. It's enough. It's great. And some people find that that's really, really helpful. And I've known people, I've felt sad listening to them practice this because they get angry with their practice because they've bought into a developmental model that somehow they're huffing and puffing to try to attain. But they're not getting there. Maybe because they're huffing and puffing, because they're too attached to the model. And so then they feel bitter about all their years of practice. That makes me so sad. I wish the person early on had learned how deeply satisfying one moment of mindfulness can be. And so they don't regret the practice they've done because each moment was so wonderful. Isn't that great? However, each moment of mindfulness, if you put those moments of mindfulness together in some quality way, will create the conditions so the heart will evolve and change. So it doesn't mean that things have to stay the way they are. Things will still evolve and change. You'll follow the path. You'll develop yourself. Those moments of deep, satisfying mindfulness. And you don't have to leave that development to chance. You can also gently, or not so gently, appropriately, participate in strengthening and developing and following a path more and more. So, for example, you could sit more. You can meditate more. You can go on retreats. You can develop spiritual friendships. You can practice generosity. There's a lot of things you can pick up that feel natural enough to help kind of move the process along rather than just letting mindfulness and being present be the only thing that develops the path. Does that make sense? So two things. I'm very fond of a quote by Suzuki Roshi where he said, "You're perfect just the way you are." So, when you hear that, you're supposed to, oh yes, that's great. You're supposed to relax. Ah, yes. You're perfect just the way you are. And there's room for improvement. So to hold both together. So one of the ways I like to hold the developmental model, or to hold myself as a practitioner, is that once you're on the path or in the practicing, in a sense, you're kind of like the path is being held in the palms of the Buddha. And that kind of being held in the palms of the Buddha for me, it means like things are just, you know, things are just as they are, taken care of. Somehow you're being supported. Things are just right. So a certain part of me can relax because I'm on the path. You're perfect just the way you are, and there's room for improvement. Both can be true. And then, finally, from the Dhammapada. Ah, so happily we live without hate among those with hate. Among people who hate, we live without hate. Ah, So happily we live without misery among those in misery. Among people in misery, we live without misery. Ah. So happily we live without ambition among those with ambition. Among people who are ambitious, we live without ambition. Ah. So happily we live, we who have no attachments. We shall feast on joy as do the radiant gods. Health is the foremost possession. Contentment, the foremost wealth. Trust, the foremost kinship. And liberation, the foremost happiness. So I hope you all take liberation very seriously. But more important for me than that is that, from my view of human beings, is that you give enough space, enough time, contemplative time, to really allow the unfolding, the blossoming of what is most beautiful in your own hearts. And I believe that if you allow that blossoming to happen in your own particular way, that each of you is unique, that if given enough time and development, given enough care and love, that it will blossom in liberation. So, thank you.